Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Cases on Hold, number 84. This is a wonderful time to be out and about. It is warm in the month of June, no matter where you are, hopefully, unless you're in Australia and it's cold there because it's the winter. My name is Antonia Chen. I am now executive editor at JBJS, and I'd like to introduce to you.
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
Remember that all these are our opinions. They don't represent anyone at JBJS or any information at JBJS. They're clearly just us and our opinions and thoughts. This is brought to you by JBJS Family of Publications. There are so many options in publications. There's open access. There'll be a new methods one coming out. And there's another version of the open access, looking at methodology. JBJS clinical classrooms. There's so many different ways to engage in education and learning. So please go ahead and check out jbjs.org and check out all the different options there. We're going to start out with top of the pile. Secondary analysis from the PrEP-IT trial by Hagen et al. It's permanently free. What's new in spine surgery by Chung et al. It's permanently free. Lessons learned in medicine and life by Shinek. Permanently free. Skin antisepsis and the surgical treatment of extremity fractures. Should we reject the null hypothesis by Detti et al.? There's a commentary and it's permanently free. Kienbock disease. Recent advances understanding and management by Lichtman et al. It's permanently free. Muscle-derived mitochondria as a novel therapy for muscle degeneration after rotator cuff tears by Xu et al. Also, there's a commentary on this. AOA Critical Issue Symposium, Development of an Adaptive Learning Platform in Orthopedics by Kyoto. A bioethical perspective on orthopedic robotic-assisted surgery. Consent, Access, and Accountability by Rana et al. Unlike acetabular antiversion, femoral antiversion is not associated with the hip coronal morphotype. An anatomic basis for the new hip morphotype classification, a total hip arthroplasty by Sarah Lee et al. Stacked cone constructs for the treatment of extensive tibia bone loss and revision total knee arthroplasty, a series of 22 patients by Heckman et al. Reliability and diagnostic accuracy of EOS full body upright imaging for sarcopenia, a retrospective study comparing thigh muscle to CT-derived psoas muscle measurements by Nasser. The rise of Medicare Advantage is impacting the fidelity of national Medicare claims data. Implications of reporting of long-term total knee arthroplasty survivorship by Chen et al., not me. Outcomes of transfibular total ankle arthroplasty, clinical and radiographic analysis of 130 cases with a minimum of 5-year follow-up by Day et al., and reevaluating the impact of including patients with bilateral conditions in orthopedic clinical research studies when 1 plus 1 does not equal 2 by Carey et al. Without further ado, why don't you tell us about your headlines of isolation of multiple positive cultures at resection arthroplasty is a predictor of failure following reimplantation by Terabici et al. And there's a commentary for this as well.
So in the last episode, I talked about how when the list of articles, candidate articles for inclusion come out, that my agent called me up and was like, I don't want you to touch these. Please do not comment on these articles. And I just turned around and commented on both articles that, well, one that they told me not to, and then the other one they probably should have told me not to, but I didn't. And then they were like, I can't believe you did the opposite of what I told you in episode 83. Don't do this one in episode 84. So now I'm just going, whichever one my agent says I shouldn't be doing, that's the one that I'm probably going to pick as my headline going forward. So
positive thinking.
Yeah. So let's talk about multiple positive cultures at resection arthroplasty and how this might impact failure following replantation. This is a study that, you know, is conducted on patients who had undergone two-stage exchange arthroplasty for management of chronic PJI between 2011 and 2020 at one of three tertiary care centers, but all part of the same Mayo Clinic system. So Arizona, Rochester, and Jacksonville, Florida. So, you know, basically the timing of replantation in patients undergoing this two-stage exchange arthroplasty, the decision on when to proceed with the second stage varied at the discretion of the surgeon. So, in this case, we are looking at a concept where it is in the hands of the surgeon to decide when they're going to do the second stage. It's also, sort of the overarching approach is basically in the hands of the surgeon. And we have issues with selection and indication in that regard. And then we also have to discuss, from a conceptual standpoint, moderation and modulation concepts. So there's factors that are predictors, there are factors that are moderators, and there are factors that are modulators. And some of this depends on conceptual model. One person's risk factor is another's moderator or modulator, so on and so forth. Some of this is arguable, but I think some of it is also logic-based. So when you have, a compelling presentation that says, this is why I'm saying it's this particular condition, and it makes sense, I think you have to kind of go with that. So in this case, obviously independent predictors are those factors that are sort of independently involved in driving the outcomes of interest. When you have moderators, those are classically when you say, like, how does this affect? And the answer is, oh, it depends. It depends on this, kind of the condition interacting, so to speak, with another aspect. And then there are modulators. Modulators are more like signals or flags that it's part of the pathway. And in this case, the multiple positive cultures is, I think, a signal for more severe infection. And hence, we're not getting multiple more cultures, or we're not finding that multiple cultures are positive, or we're not taking cultures at all in settings in which we don't suspect that something is there. And there's a Bayesian phenomenon here, because the more number of cultures you take in the number of different settings, there's going to be a higher likelihood of finding positive cultures in the first place. And the more positive cultures you have, that's usually an indication of either a more complex or a more severe infection. Joint arthroplasty specialists in the room, correct me if I'm wrong.
You're right. If they're positive and they're there, either it's a more virulent organism, or the patient has poor immunity or something like that, that they can't combat it.
So they say whether the number of positive cultures at resection was a predictor of failure in patients undergoing a two-stage exchange procedure is right there. There are several other important factors that are sort of left unmentioned that are sort of orbiting that concept. And they looked at age, sex, race, body mass index, smoking status, ASA, and laterality. Not sure how the laterality really figures into that as a risk factor, but then they have data on the number of cultures taken, specimen type, culture results, infecting organism, history of failed treatment for PJI, time from resection to reimplantation, and outcomes at latest follow-up. So then they use the, they call it univariate, but it's really bivariate, logistic regression to determine the association between different variables and the risk of failure. And then they do a multivariable analysis. Now, it's not really clear to me, and they don't say how they determined what got included in the multivariable model versus what they were making comparisons for in the bivariate model. But ultimately, they have 48 patients that experienced a treatment failure. So 48 patients with the outcome of interest. And I count 10 variables in their multivariable model. So they say the multivariable model account for age, sex, race, BMI, ASA, organism virulence, history of failed surgical treatment, time from resection to reimplantation, positive cultures at reimplantation. So that typically the standard conservative approach is you would need 200 failure events to support that multivariable model, and they have 48. So that raises concerns for this model being over-optimistic or overfit, would be another concern. And when we look at the outcomes, there's a concern for the performance of the measure. So when you're looking at how a bivariate comparison and unadjusted comparison changes when you add multiple factors in the model, ideally, your confidence interval gets narrower. So once you start adjusting for things, then you have a change in the point estimate and a narrower confidence interval. If your confidence interval is widening after you do multivariable, that indicates that there are some problems, of which there could be many, and you have to kind of sort of do a an after action sort of diagnostic assessment. But one of the things would be that like what you're controlling for is not actually like useful or informative, or it's confounding further the actual effect of your outcome of interest. But what theirs does is it's actually a frame shift. There's a frame, it just sort of shifts. It doesn't narrow, it doesn't stay within the parameters, it just changes the parameters. And this typically indicates that there's high prospect for fragility as well as residual confounding in the model. And you cannot really speak to whether this is a mediator or a modulator, given the limited numbers and given these other parameters and issues that they have within their data. But I would wager that more greater positive cultures is a modulator, a signal, a sign. And it's not in and of itself an independent factor or an explanation for the outcome. Plus, their confidence intervals are incredibly wide. The final part of the result says, after multivariable analysis, the isolation of Gordon true positive cultures increased the odds of failure by over eightfold, 8.12, with a confidence interval from 2.3 to basically 52. There's a huge lack of precision there. It was found to be the only independent predictor, they say, of failure after a two-stage exchange arthroplasty. But again, this is it's not a predictor. It's a modulator. It's a signal of the risk. The positive cultures in and of themselves reflect a decision to obtain cultures, how many of those cultures are going to be positive based on the infecting organism and things of that nature. They don't exist in a vacuum. It's not random when people are getting multiple positive cultures. And it probably doesn't exist uniformly across the spectrum of disease either. So at the end of the day, I do agree that there are multiple positive cultures. At resection, arthroplasty is likely a signal of concern for failure following reimplantation. Of course, the study doesn't really, it's left to the devices of the individual surgeon, like how you're going to approach that or what you're going to do about it. I don't know. What do you think?
It's one of those things with infection, and this is a take off a previous article that was done on, at time of reimplantation, you go in, you take numbers of cultures. So there are a few confounding factors here. One, not everyone takes cultures at the time that you're reimplanting, right? So you have that a higher risk of suspicion, or you're a higher volume center that's looking for something, things like that, right? So that's the first thing, is not everyone's doing this. It's a retrospective study. It's not a prospective study where everyone's getting it and not all comers are coming in. It is one of those things that people always ask, well, if it came positive during the time of reimplantation, should I treat it or not? And so this gives some parameters to be like, well, you should probably treat it because it's probably infected. But, does that mean you should have gone back in there and actually treated like an infection and taken care of at the same time, et cetera, or gotten a biopsy beforehand and to find out if that really was still infected? Then that's a problem. So yes, you're likely to fail because it was probably infected. It's a chicken and the egg sort of thing, right? Like the patient's more likely to be infected, and that becomes the problem at hand. So does it help with the number of culture and things like that? We always take an odd number of cultures, so there's a tiebreaker. So if just one positive culture, you're like, maybe not, but then two, okay, fine, there's a higher rate of failure, things like that. So I can see the benefit of the study and that what they were trying to aim at, but it's really hard when not everyone takes culture every single time.
Right. There's a bit, what you described is the Bayesian phenomenon of the mere fact that you order a test, you perform a test, you do something, that's already increasing the chance that it's going to be positive.
Yeah, absolutely. But
especially when it's not just done because you feel like it.
Yep.
And when the decisions about when to re-implant are going to also be informed by, the surgeons didn't just say, we'll re-implant, we don't care how many cultures were positive. I wager if the cultures were positive, it's going to be taking longer to re-implant, and maybe still there's a higher risk. You don't have a good assessment. You don't have good hands-on of the counterfactual here.
Yeah, totally agree. All right. So I want to switch it up a little bit and talk about infection in a different way. So by switching it up, we're going to talk about arthroplasty and periprosthetic joint infection, but not from the clinician standpoint, but from the patient standpoint. So this is successful management of periprosthetic joint infection following total joint arthroplasty as defined by the patient, a qualitative study by Enterazzi et al. There's a commentary, there's an infographic, and it's free for 30 days. So this is a shameless personal plug that please go read this article, because this really was a labor of love, and it actually was a pretty interesting article to participate in. So my colleagues up in University of Toronto reached out, and they're much more compassionate in Canada than we were in Boston. So they said, you know what, we're really curious about what the definition of success for periprosthetic joint infection from the patient perspective, not just the provider perspective. Typically, we look at reinfection, reoperation, readmission. Are you still taking antibiotics? Are there still signs of infection? And if there's not, then we're like high-fiving each other. That's successful treatment of infection. But my colleagues up in the University of Toronto at Sinai Health said that they wanted to see and survey patients in two different regional areas to see and understand what their success in PJI treatment was. And the idea is that these PJI treatments had to have at least 1 year follow-up at the time of survey, but no more than 5 years, because you don't have any recall bias, or after 5 years, it's really hard to recall all the information associated with your PJI treatment. The primary objective of the study was to characterize the experience of patients undergoing this PJI management, and the secondary and tertiary aims were to identify factors that patients associate with successful treatment and to assess alignment with the 2019 ORT, which is an outcome reporting tool by the Musculoskeletal Infection Society, or MSIS. From August 2023 to April 2024, participants participated in a semi-structured interviews with a feminological approach. So what it does, it provides detailed examination of personal lived experiences and to identify themes regarding how a particular phenomenon is experienced. Interview topics included experiences with primary TJA, PJI diagnosis and management, and patient perceptions of the success of the PJI management. A shout out to Bihar and to Joshua for conducting these studies and these conversations with patients, because it took a while. These interviews were transcribed then, and the thematic analysis was performed by two team members with the use of six phrase models outlined by Braun and Clark to support the distinctiveness, stability, granularity, and inclusiveness of coding. 20% of the interviews underwent independent duplicate coding by a second reviewer, and any discrepancies were worked out between the two of them until consensus were made. And then concordance between patient-defined and MSIS-ORT, defined treatment success, was calculated. And again, this MSIS outcome reporting tool was this treatment success protocol by Fillingham et al., and they classified success as tiers ones and tier two, on focus on antibiotic and surgical management, but tier three were failures. So 93 patients were contacted who had periprosthetic joint infection, of which only 27 consented to participate and were involved in this study. So not a high percentage of patients wanted to talk about this, which is probably understandable for a pretty traumatic event that happened in their life. Of these patients, surgically, 44% underwent debridement, antibiotic, and implant retention, or an IND and poly exchange. 19% underwent single-stage revision arthroplasty, and 37% underwent two-stage revision arthroplasty. There were 67% male patients, and the mean duration of follow-up was 3 years, with the range of 1 to 4.8 years in that area there. And thematic analysis of these patient interviews came up with four phases. And I'm going to go through each of these four phases. And a common theme across the phases was a negative impact on patient mental health, which was reported by 78% of patients. So really big impact that we don't really capture in any of our success or non-success metrics. So one of the first phases was PJI onset. When they noticed infectious symptoms, 8 patients stated that their feelings or concerns were dismissed or invalidated when they first contacted their healthcare provider and delayed their diagnosis of PJI. 3 patients didn't seek care immediately upon symptom onset, and 6 patients specified that there was uncertainty surrounding the cause of their symptoms, which led them to feelings of helplessness, like they had pain, but it was unexplained pain and it wasn't worked up, and that was a concern. The second phase was PJI diagnosis. There were a lot of negative feelings associated with PJI diagnosis: sadness, anger, surprise, disappointment, confusion, and feeling overwhelmed. While all patients recalled being warned of the possibility of infection during the surgical consent process, none of them felt that they were adequately informed of the risk and severity of infection. Only 3 patients specifically recalled that their surgeon had warned them of an increased likelihood of infection due to their particular medical comorbidity, such as diabetes, smoking, obesity. The lack of understanding of periprosthetic joint infection among patients contributed to negative emotions, such as surprise and feeling overwhelmed that they experienced at the time of PJI diagnosis, and 33% felt that their course of non-operative treatment was protracted, i.e. getting antibiotics, which delayed their definitive treatment. Next was operative course and rehabilitation. All patients received antibiotics during the course of their periprosthetic joint infection treatment, with 41% experiencing adverse effects. 37% expressed frustration with the frequency of antibiotic administration, and 11% specifically reported that there was a burdensome care if you had a PICC line or a peripherally inserted central catheter, which disrupted their daily lives. There were physical limitations during their operative course and rehabilitation, more common among two-stage replacement patients as opposed to DARE or single-stage placement. And they had to rely on friends and family members, and they really had a loss of self-sufficiency and had feelings of dependency, which they didn't like. There was also ambiguity regarding the treatment timeline and the lack of guarantee regarding infection eradication, which also fueled mental health challenges in this phase of PJI management. As a provider on the other side of things, saying, I can't guarantee that we're going to necessarily cure your infection, I can see how that's a mental health barrier for our patients, especially something when you want an effective cure and you never want to have to go through it again. And the final phase, the fourth phase, was long-term sequelae. Even after periprosthetic joint infection treatment and rehabilitation, 52% of patients reported continuing to struggle with physical limitations that impacted their daily lives, again, more so in the two-stage patients than the one-stage or the DARE patients. And 9 patients had persistently low mood even after operative course and rehabilitation. 6 patients had ongoing uncertainty and fear surrounding infection recurrence, with 2 describing post-traumatic symptoms with regards to the suffering surrounding their surgeries. 3 described feelings of isolation and perceived lack of understanding of their circumstances by others. So when patients were asked about the definition of success, all patients did assign value to infection eradication. That's where we see eye to eye. Providers want to see infection eradication. Patients want to see infection eradication. But patients also consistently emphasize the importance of function, being able to resume day-to-day activities, pain relief, mobility, and independence. And patients valued expertise with clear and thorough communication, compassion, continuity of care, and collaboration between their surgical team and other medical experts. Now, we talked about the MSIS outcome reporting tool. 63% of the patients considered to have successful PJI management. However, 33% of the patients didn't agree with the definition and thought that there'd be their definition of success didn't align with the clinician's definition of success. So in conclusion, success defined by a patient for PJI treatment versus success defined by a provider who's treating PJI did not seem to be the same based on this study. So I understand this is a qualitative study. It's got its inherent limitations. And of course, the patient cohort could be expanded. I'd love to see this in all countries and all different regional areas, but it does give some insights that we may need patient-reported outcomes that are sensitive to patients who are undergoing periprosthetic joint infections. And our metrics and patient metrics may not be the same. And I don't think there's a sensitive tool right now to actually capture the outcomes after devastating complications like periprosthetic joint infections.
Yeah, I mean, you're always going to be challenged with qualitative research in terms of, you know, just the sheer amount of effort that it goes into gleaning this type of information from semi-structured interviews or key informant interviews or however you're going about obtaining the data and then doing the thematic analysis and things like that. Just you can't do it on everyone and you can't do it in large numbers. So it gives very in-depth granular insights into the patient experience, some findings of which can, I think, be arguably inferred to be translatable, although they cannot objectively be shown to be so. So there's a lot of interesting and valuable insights here. Of course, this would not be considered definitive. It's not something that I think testable items for any kind of in-training exam or board certification should come out of. You know, generally, qualitative research is viewed as hypothesis generating rather than practice informative. But it does suggest some important points, all of which I agree with everything you raised.
Nothing comfortable at this point in time, agreed. All right, we're going to shift to another arthroplasty topic. We're going to talk about ratio of weight to tibial base plate surface area and predicting aseptic tibial loosening in total knee arthroplasty and the protective effect of tibial stem extensions by Huber Schmin et al. And there's a commentary on that. This is the Your Case is on Hold featurette. So previous studies have demonstrated that high body mass index is a risk factor for tibial base plate loosening following total knee arthroplasty. But this may not adequately correlate with stresses at the tibial base plate. So this study out of NYU wanted to see if there's an optimal weight to tibial base plate surface area cutoff for predicting aseptic tibial base plate loosening. And they wanted to see if tibial stem extensions had a protective effect for preventing tibial loosening in patients with high BMI. So there's a total of over 16,000 patients who were retrospectively identified in their hospital system. and they underwent primary unilateral elective total knee arthroplasty from June 2011 to March 2023. And they looked at patient demographics, age, sex, race, implants used, revision, and partial knee replacement. Revision and partial knee replacements were excluded. Patients were excluded if they received tibial base plates used in less than 200 cases. So given that 16,000 patients, they said if they used less than 200 times, they were out. So it reduced variability. This included 56 surgeons in the study population of people doing the surgery. So huge variety of approaches, huge variety of things. But the implants were looked across all these different areas. Revisions were manually reviewed to confirm revision indications. And the exact surface areas of tibia base plates were obtained from manufacturers. A weight to base plate surface area was calculated for each case by dividing patient weight at the time of surgery by kilograms by the tibial base plate surface area of millimeters squared. And then receiver operating curves were done to determine the utility of BMI and weight surface areas for predicting aseptic tibial base plate loosening. And then optimal weight and surface area, weight per surface area, and BMI cutoffs were determined. The effect of tibial stem extensions were examined in patients who were above the cutoff, which was 7,698, and then below were 8,670 with stem extension. And so it's pretty similar in terms of the cohorts above and below. So of this 16,368 patients, the mean age was 67 years old, with 87% being female and 54% being white. Both BMI and weight per surface area of the tibial implant were significant predictors of aseptic tibial base plate loosening requiring revision. The weight per surface area that was a predictor of aseptic tibial base plate loosening was a cutoff was 0.0162. And the optimal cutoff for BMI for tibial base plate loosening was 32.5. Multivariable logistic regression demonstrated that at or being above the weight over surface area cutoff had 3 times increased risk for tibial aseptic tibial plate loosening. That said, that was not true for BMI. So it was a little more sensitive and specific with regards to the weight per surface area ratio. Following the stratification, again, of these two groups, the rate of revision for aseptic tibial base plate loosening was 0.6 in the total sample. So not a lot of loosening. Over 16,000 people. There were no cases of revision for aseptic tibial base plate loosening in patients with stem extensions, either above or below the cutoff. The rate of revision for aseptic base plate loosening in patients without stem extensions was 0.3 for patients below and 1% for patients at above the weight cutoff. So it was higher if they had a higher weight per surface area ratio. There was no significant association between tibial base plate design of symmetric and asymmetric and the rate of revision for aseptic tibial base plate loosening in the total sample or when analyzing only patients without tibial stem extensions. So the conclusion is that this weight to tibial base plate surface area, which is based off manufacturer's calculations and that's just a number that's known, was predictive for revision for aseptic tibial base plate loosening and it was better than BMI alone. So with patients who are obese or you're worried about this weight to tibial base plate ratio, the idea is using a stem extension might really reduce the likelihood of any loosening. So this is a single center study. They did exclude cases of implants that there were too few of them in their system to look at. So it is useful information, although it was surprising to me that the BMI cutoff was 32.5 that they said. So, you know, I personally would use a short stubby stem in a larger patient with a higher BMI, but perhaps we need to consider this when taking care of our patients and our cemented patients.
An interesting study. I think there are some, you know, a few caveats here. Obviously, it's a rare event rate. It's 0.6% in the total sample. So that comes in somewhere right about, you know, a shade over 100 patients. So a pretty confiscatory number of individuals with the outcome of interest relative to the total sample. Some of these parameters are just going to be based on the, I recognize it's 56 surgeons in a very large academic medical center that's high volume, but you're still going to be constrained by the culture of that institution or the practices that are contributing patients. And I was struck as well about the optimal cutoff for BMI was identified at you know basically 32.5 And we've discussed sort of, you know, the use of like 40 as a cutoff. I saw a patient today in my clinic. Obviously, I don't treat total knees. They just had it incidentally, but they had bilateral total knees fairly recently, and their BMI was 47. So, you know, I'm thinking about like the patients that I see, many of whom have higher BMIs. And I don't know if this is just sort of an artifact of some of the selection in terms of, you know, if you have a population that was more inclined to do surgery in heavier patients, is that number going to change? Potentially it could. Also, you know, concerned with the number of variables that they're including in the model relative to the outcome of interest, that always raises, you know, they tried to do some corrections for that in some ways. They're, you know, focused on the variance inflation factor. But ultimately, while it is a large number of patients, I think you have to recognize it's done from a single center with the baked in cultural practices and what they're willing to operate on and how they're willing to approach those cases in a retrospective work such as this. And those are opportunities for bias that shouldn't be ignored in my estimation.
Totally agree. All right. Let's bring it across to these honorable mentions. Therapeutic effects of bovine colostrum on bone healing, rehabilitation, and postoperative complications, a prospective randomized double-blinded comparative trial by Guhari et al. With a commentary, infographic, and free for 30 days. The aim of this study was to evaluate the impact of colostrum supplementation on bone healing in patients with a traumatic extracapsular hip fracture. Patients with extracapsular hip fracture undergoing internal fixation randomly assigned to receive either bovine colostrum or whey protein. And bone healing was assessed using the RUSH scale, which is the radiographic union score for hip. And this study shows preliminary evidence suggesting that colostrum may accelerate bone healing and significantly greater increase the RUSH score and enhance short-term physical rehabilitation outcomes as demonstrated by greater decreases in SMFA dysfunction and other and bother indexes compared to whey protein. So use your colostrum instead of your whey protein in your patients. A prospective double-blinded randomized controlled trial comparing the direct superior approach versus the posterior approach for total hip arthroplasty by Kayani et al. And it's free for 30 days. Comparing the direct superior approach to the posterior approach in a randomized trial with identical implants, there were no difference in baseline characteristics, and there were no significant differences in groups with respect to postoperative pain scores at 24 hours using the visual analog score. The overall time to hospital discharge and the number of superficial wound infections was similar between groups, and there were no further complications or harm sustained by patients in either group. Adding to the age-old literature of does the approach really matter? And the answer is, as long as you do it well, probably not. Finally, assessing the need for additional syndesmotic stabilization, open reduction of the posterior malleolus, a biomechanical study by Millistri et al. There's a visual summary and it's permanently free. The treatment of ankle fractures involving the posterior malleolus has changed in favor of open reduction and internal fixation, and the need for additional syndesmotic stabilization has decreased. However, there are still doubts regarding the diagnosis and treatment of residual syndesmotic instability. The aim of the present study was to evaluate the effect of fixation of the posterior malleolus and to assess the need for additional stabilization methods. In the author's biomechanical cadaver models, isolated posterior malleolus osteotomy and isolated anterior inferior tibial fibial ligament and IOL rupture after posterior malleolus refixation only partially increased fibular motion in dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. For the combination of posterior malleolar osteotomy and anterior inferior tibial fibular ligament and anterior osseous ligament rupture resulted in unstable syndesmosis in all planes. So be careful of those posterior malles. This is a cadaver study, but you might be careful of like, you know, look at the syndesmosis. That's it for now. A lot on our plate. We're looking forward to the next time. Please join us next time.